Morning, everybody.
This end all week.
Your Honor, may I please court? My name is Charles Brewster. I represent the defendant appellant Andrew Casterline in this direct appeal today. Andrew Casterline was convicted in the district court of Webster County of the offenses of first degree murder, use of a weapon in the commission of a felony, and burglary. At his sentencing, he was committed to the Department of Corrections for life and given the maximum sentence consecutive on the other two felony counts. This whole very bizarre circumstance started in a little town in Webster County in 2013 called Guide Rock. Guide Rock is east of Red Cloud, which is the county seat in Webster County. All due respect to the residents of Guide Rock, it's not a very nice little town. Looks like Judge Castle maybe have been there, but smile. But this is where Andrew Casterline was living in the summer and fall of 2013. He came there from Tennessee following his mother, Shelley Casterline, who went there with the idea that they could get free housing through some houses that her daughters owned there in Guide Rock. One of the other characters in this whole scenario was a fellow named Ron Jamalowski. Shelley Casterline and Ron Jamalowski had an on-again, off-again relationship, very stormy relationship. Jamalowski was also living in Guide Rock. The final person involved in the scenario is Virginia Barone. She's the lady that was killed on October 4th, 2013. Virginia Barone was the mother of Ron Jamalowski and maintained a very stormy relationship with the defendant appellant's mother, Shelley, during the time that they were all living in Guide Rock. I should have drawn a diagram for you. It'd be easier to see. These people lived in houses that were all grouped together in one little corner of Guide Rock, and they were going in and out of each other's houses all the time. Everybody was drinking. Everybody was using drugs, except the victim, Mrs. Barone. And apparently, she wasn't a participant in this, but it was just a horrible mess. On October 4th of 2013, the early morning hours, Shelley Casterline went to Virginia Barone's house under the auspice or the idea that she needed to get her cell phone out of Mrs. Barone's car. Went inside, they got into a horrible argument, which was not unusual for them. They fought like, you know, cats and dogs all the time. The appellant, Andrew Casterline, he shows up there, and according to the testimony of Shelley, Shelley tells Andrew, get out of the house, get out of here. So he walks out, he leaves. At this point in time, the argument gets physical, gets extremely violent, and Shelley stabs Virginia Barone 22 times and kills her. Andrew Casterline comes back in the house, looks and sees what his mother has done. You know, oh my God, now what do we do? And so they talk for a while. The testimony from the trial by Shelley was that they decided they needed to move Mrs. Barone's body to a back room in the house. Andrew helped her do that. At some point, Shelley got a hold of Mrs. Barone's bank card and got into her car, told Andrew to go pack his bags, we're leaving, and so they took off from Guide Rock and went on, I guess I call it a sojourn, through central Nebraska using Mrs. Barone's bank cards to get money. There was a significant amount of evidence of that from videos at Walmarts and the like. They ended up in Jasper County, Iowa. That's where Newton is on the interstate, Interstate 80. And they got pulled over there by Iowa State troopers and were arrested. Andrew and Shelley Casterline were both in the Newton County, or I'm sorry, the Jasper County jail. At that time, there was a letter that was placed in the outgoing mail that was allegedly written by Andrew Casterline to Ron Jamielowski. That would have been the son of the deceased. Also, Iowa State troopers did recover a steak knife out of the vehicle that Shelley Casterline and Andrew Casterline were driving. Those two exhibits become important because we objected during the course of the trial.
What were the objections as to each one of these?
For the letter, the objections were towards relevancy and lack of foundation.
What were they offer for consciousness or guilt?
The letter has some incriminating statements in them, depending on how you interpret it.
Relevancy is kind of a weak objection, but you claim there wasn't any foundation for proving that Andrew Casterline actually wrote and mailed that letter from the jail, that somebody else could have easily have done the same thing.
That's the position that we take. Shelley Casterline was in the jail, too.
Was incriminating about the letter?
Well, it... Now, remember, we're dealing with the felony murder rule here, unfortunately. There was a statement in the letter about my mother killed your mother. This is the letter to Ron Jamielowski, and because mom needed money to get out of here. And now the cops are blaming me. I didn't do it, but this is what happens. So essentially, in the letter, he admits to participation in part of this.
Mostly exculpatory, though, isn't it?
Well,
shifting.
He tried.
Okay. Shifting the blame. Okay.
Yeah.
Your position is they didn't prove that the Casterline actually wrote the letter, didn't have any comparison of the writing samples or any of the other requirements.
They had none of that.
Okay.
And, you know, Judge, this isn't a love letter to his girlfriend we're talking about here. This is a letter that essentially has inculpatory statements in it. I would have thought that in the court's discretion they would have required more than, hey, this was posted in the jail.
And you mentioned that the steak knife, there was no DNA of Casterline on the knife.
There was.
Oh, that was his, he had his DNA on the knife.
Yeah, he had what they call
palm DNA.
Touch DNA.
Touch DNA.
No DNA of Barone.
I beg your pardon?
But no DNA of Barone on that knife, right?
No, no blood, no DNA of Barone, nothing. It was just a steak knife, and this is important, with a 4-inch blade. Steak knife with a 4-inch blade found in the glove box of this Jeep that they were in, and there wasn't any fingerprint, but there was some touch DNA from Andrew Casterline on that knife blade.
Let me go back to the sufficiency of the evidence with regard to first-degree murder. Was there also a charge or an instruction as to felony murder?
There was.
What's the felony that was committed in connection with the murder?
Question.
Did they steal something from Barone?
Oh, yeah. Our position and her testimony, she, after Barone was dead, she took her bank card, and they also took her car, and
isn't that a felony in commission of, or isn't that a robbery in which the person dies? You're saying that these acts occurred after the deceased had...
That's exactly right.
After the deceased died.
Right. I mean, she was long gone.
Does it make any difference?
Well, I think what makes the most difference is that the appellant really didn't have any clue what was going on until it was all over with.
But that's a factual issue that the jury resolved against it.
Well, it is. I would suggest that there was no evidence to the contrary, and you know, we've made that insufficient evidence argument in the brief. I know that's a high hill to climb.
Wouldn't that be kind of an absurd result that if you stabbed somebody and you took the money while she was still bleeding to death, you get charged with felony murder, but if you don't touch anything until the deceased has died and then take the stuff, then you can't charge felony murder because it occurred after the deceased was dead? That wouldn't be a very good rule, would it?
Well, I don't know. I've never liked the felony murder rule. There's so many scenarios that you can come up with where you have...
But you would concede that things were stolen from Barone at the time that she was murdered.
No question.
Okay.
They were.
But you're trying, ignoring, so to speak, these hypotheticals with respect to your client. Is this correct that you're saying the evidence shows he comes upon the victim who is deceased and then proceeds to do a robbery and deal with the body?
Can you rob somebody that's dead?
Well, you...
I don't mean to be a smart aleck.
Yeah, no, what I'm trying to say is if he's not participating in the killing, he may be participating in aiding and abetting or doing stuff after the killing. I'm trying to separate out by virtue of the timeline as distinguished from the other participant.
Yes. I would suggest...
And what would be the nature of the charge based on that, if that's the fact?
I would suggest that Andrew Casterline's participation and behavior here made him an accessory.
It's an accessory app. He comes into this after the victim has died.
Yes. Because what he did was he aided Shelley Casterline, who stabbed this poor woman to death, in...
Those are questions for the jury.
Was there an aiding and abetting instruction?
Yes, there was. And that's the other part of the argument in the brief, Judge, that we're very concerned about. The trial judge did not use the pattern jury instructions for first-degree murder, second-degree murder, or manslaughter. At the request of the state, the trial judge added the words aiding and abetting to those very basic elements.
Well, was it aiding and abetting, or was it alone or assisted? Or I can't. That's all right. Go ahead.
Yeah.
In addition to the elements, there was an aiding and abetting instruction.
There was. And
is there something to suggest to the jury what the timeline may have been, like an accessory?
No.
After?
No. There was not. Our position is that so much aiding and abetting language in those instructions confuse the jurors and, if you will, pushed them that, you know, if you see anything that is aiding and abetting, then, you know, you must convict this guy.
Was there really anything in the instructions, though, that differ from the instructions that were given in State versus Brunzo, in which this court said those were okay?
Brunzo's different, and both factually, well, mostly factually. You know, Brunzo's a gang-related deal, and there was ample evidence that Brunzo was in the van where the victim was and did all kinds of things leading up to when the victim was killed. And
that's a factual issue. That's not an issue about whether the instructions were correct, but in those Brunzo and another case, didn't we approve essentially these instructions?
Essentially you did, but and I understand the factual part of this, Your Honor. The bottom line is that we don't live in a vacuum with instructions. The instructions have to fit what the facts are being presented to the jurors.
Do you think the jury is adequately informed about, with respect to the murder charge, aiding and or abetting and or somehow an accessory concept as distinguished from the count on burglary? Is there a separate count on burglary?
All right, this will sound odd, but you know what? Andrew Casterline is completely 100% guilty of burglary. And we didn't really care about that at the time. There's no question that he burglarized Trevor Merrihew's house. And he and his mother both did it together.
But that has nothing to do with the murder.
No, no, it does it, not.
And it can't be the felony that would be the basis for felony murder.
No. It because it happened in a completely different location long after Mrs. Barone was deceased. So
if the defendant is with his mother when they burglarize and then they take the stuff and sell it to a pawn shop, he's either an aider and a better or actual participant in the crime of burglary.
I think the evidence, if I recall correctly, he was in there loading up Trevor Merrihew's property. That's just...
No, you're not arguing.
Not at all. The state proved that without any question.
But my questions go to whether or not the jury's confused about their consideration of separate counts when they get all this at one time.
Well, again, you know, these cases aren't in a vacuum. And were they confused? I think clearly they were confused by the aiding and the abetting issue by virtue of the question they sent out to the trial court about, what was the line?
Wanting to see the law.
Yeah, why would they want to do that?
They didn't trust the trial judge, perhaps?
Oh, you know, well, you were on the district bench for a long time. You know the funny questions you get.
Yes.
I like this one. The question was, could we get a copy of the state law that states how you are guilty by association? And of course, Judge Illingworth sent a response that said, you must follow the law as it was given to you, which is standard.
I'm curious, was Shelley Casterline charged?
Oh, yes. Same charges. She pled guilty to second-degree murder. And my client chose to go to trial. So
the basic defense was I didn't participate in those
exactly
activities.
You know, he was there. He's clearly guilty of being an accessory, Your Honor. There's no doubt about
after the fact.
Yeah, you know, he never wielded a knife. He didn't have any idea that this was happening.
And that theory was presented to the jury.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Ad nauseum.
Thank you.
So, I see I have a little bit of time left for rebuttal. I'm sure Mr. Liss is going to have plenty of things to visit with you about. So, if there are no other questions at this point, I think I'll sit down.
Thank you very much. Mr. Liss, good morning to you.
Morning, Your Honors. Please the court. Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the Appalachian State of Nebraska. As far as the jury instruction claim, the state maintains that the district court did not err by including the aiding and abetting language in the elements instruction for first-degree murder. The aiding and abetting language was warranted by the evidence at trial, and it's a correct statement of the law. Consistent with the law in general, that an aider and abetter may be held liable as the principal. It's consistent with and nearly identical to the aiding and abetting language that this court approved in Brunzo and Mantich. We also submit that it's consistent with, or at least not inconsistent with, NJI. So we submit that there was no error with respect to the aiding and abetting language.
The discussion in NJI, though, that comes in the instruction regarding aiding and abetting. And as I understand the appellant's argument, his complaint is that it was a separate instruction and it was also thrown in the elements and it shouldn't have been in both places, that it should not have been in the elements. When I read the NJI comments, those are under the aiding and abetting statute.
That's
nothing
correct.
That says that it should also be in the elements instruction.
That's true, but when I look at the comments for the aiding and abetting instruction, the example they gave that I pointed to in my brief with the felony murder type situation with bank robbery, I mean, they're saying within that aiding and abetting instruction, if you give it, you should say that they're guilty of this offense if they aided and abetted another. And I guess in my mind, that's really no different than including that in an elements instruction. I don't see any difference between throwing that into an aiding and abetting instruction and actually having elements instruction saying you're guilty if you aid and abet another. To me, it's one and the same. I see the difference. And it's a correct statement of the law. Are in fact guilty by aiding and abetting another. We see no error with respect to including that in an elements instruction.
What was the evidence that he actually aided or abetted the murder itself?
The evidence as a whole went toward that. I guess the primary evidence I would point to would be the fact that it's undisputed they were both there at or near the time of this fight. Denny Barone sustained 22 stab wounds, which varied from a half inch to 8.5 inches in length, and 7 of which were at an upward trajectory, 13 of which were at a downward trajectory, suggesting that more than one knife might have been used. Then you look at everything that folded afterward, from them stealing things and pawning them to using her bank account, which he was doing.
So the state's theory was both Shelley and is it Andrew, were both stabbers?
Yes. I guess the other thing I guess I find
and why is that? Is there a difference in height when you're talking about downward and upward? Is there some significance there of height between Mrs. Casterline and her son?
I don't know that there was necessarily a significance there, but it's the state's theory that both were involved and the fact that you have two different trajectories of the knife would at least support that theory.
Or that the victim was standing at one point and laying down at the other.
I'm sorry, what?
Or it could also support that the victim was standing during some of those stab wounds and laying down for others. Would
it could
get upward and downward trajectory then, too?
It could be. I mean, it's possible, but we'll never know.
So that's the best evidence that there were two stabbers?
Well, I think it's based on circumstantial evidence, the theory, which is permissible. But yeah, I mean, I think that's as good as it gets. So, well, I guess you look at the fact afterward. I mean, he's got blood on his shoe, on his jeans from Virginia Barone.
But he admits to, or at least there's testimony that he helped carry the body afterwards, in which case the blood could have been on his shoe.
That's his theory.
I mean, the blood on his shoe establishes that he was there and he had contact with the body. Question is, was he stabbing at the time or was he not a participant in that particular activity? Isn't that right?
Right.
So did he testify at trial?
He did not.
Okay, so what evidence do you have that supports the foundation for the letter that he allegedly wrote?
As far as the letter, it was observed and documented by jail staff as part of the jail's inmate mail monitoring policy. The jail's log report shows that Andrew Casterline mailed the letter in question to Ronald Jemelowski on October 10, 2013, while he was in custody at the jail. Name and return address on the letter is listed as Andrew Casterline with the Jasper County Jail address.
There was no testimony from Shelley that she actually wrote the letter or anything?
There was not. And when you look at the substance of the letter, I think the substance of the letter suggests that he wrote it, and he's attempting to blame her for everything. So I think...
What about the evidence of felony murder? Was that... Their argument is that you can't commit felony murder after the person's been killed.
That's the defense's position. The state's theory in this case, which the evidence supports, is that... the burglary and or robbery occurred prior to the death, and I think that's established by the fact that they obtained her PIN number for the bank card. They couldn't have done that after she was dead. And the state's evidence clearly established that there's no ability to call in, as she claims she did, there's no ability to call into the bank.
Because the banks, don't keep the PIN numbers. They destroy them immediately after they're issued.
Correct.
Okay.
So they had to get it from her while she was alive.
Exactly.
And so the stealing was actually her cards and her... And the access to her bank account.
Stole her car as well.
And her car.
So while the defense's theory is that he wasn't involved, and we have to look at this accessory after the fact theory, we disagree. We think evidence establishes that the felony did in fact occur prior to her death.
Well, what's the significance of the knife as evidence that he did have his DNA on it, but there wasn't any blood of the victim on it? Right?
That's correct.
So the very fact that his DNA is on the knife and the person was killed by the knife makes this evidence relevant to the trial.
Absolutely. As far as the issue with the knife on appeal, the question is whether it was properly admitted, more specifically whether it was relevant, and if so, whether it was nonetheless unduly prejudicial. The state's response with respect to that issue is twofold, as set forth in our brief. The first response is that this issue was waived below. Castroline did not timely object on relevance grounds to the knife, and there was never any objection on 403 grounds based on my review of the record. And our second response would be that this issue is properly before the court. This court addresses that claim as a matter of plain error, that the knife was in fact relevant, and probative value outweighed any danger or prejudice given the facts of the case.
There was evidence. Did Shelley Castroline testify?
She did.
And she testified that there was evidence of another knife.
She claimed that she alone stabbed Barone and that she threw the knife she used to kill her into a field as they were leaving town. And as far as the knife found in the Jeep, she claimed that that knife, she took it from the hotel in Plattsmouth where she stayed when Andrew got arrested for the DUI. That was her testimony.
Okay. So there, and there also was evidence that two knives could have been used in this homicide.
Correct.
Was that from the pathologist's testimony?
Yes, I believe that was from the pathologist. Okay. And that the stab was in this case buried in length from 1/2 inch to 8.5 inches. So the fact that some of the wounds might have been longer than 4 relevant. If there are no further questions, I ask that you affirm the judgment of the district. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, 2 minutes 28 seconds.
2 minutes and 28 seconds, Mr. Brewster.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be brief.
Judge Connolly asked about stab wounds and height and things like that. We had a wonderful pathologist testify at this trial named Dr. Erin Lindy out of Omaha. Her testimony was that you can't really tell the height of the person doing the stabbing. She even went so far as to say you can't tell if they were laying down or bent over or what. You know, you just can't tell. Couldn't tell the number of people that had stabbed or even really the number of knives that were used. What's important, though, is that she did testify that the knife would had to have been 6 inches long. The knife that they recovered from the Jeep in Iowa had a blade of only 4 inches. This is the one with no blood and just a little touch DNA.
Well, are you saying that all the wounds were 8 inches deep?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
Are you claiming that all the wounds...
No.
Some of them were less than that.
Yes, that's true. Some of them were just...
So that could indicate that the steak knife was used on those.
It could.
And could the 6-inch... Did Shelley describe how long the blade was in the knife she allegedly threw away?
She did not. She did state that she threw the knife away... And I would submit to you that the blood on Andrew Castroline's shoe and pants, there were just a couple of drops, could have come from the knife that she had in the car when they were driving away from the...
It also could have come when he's moving the body.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Yeah, that's true, too.
What about the pin number? What's the significance of that?
Well, you know, Shelley said she called the bank, and the state put on evidence that you can't call the bank and find out the PIN number. The state's point was very well made, very well taken. That made no sense whatsoever. But she just insisted that that's what she did, and that's probably a bunch of baloney. I don't know about you justices. every PIN number I've got is for bank cards is written in my house someplace. I don't think it would have been too tough for Shelley to find the PIN number for that bank card. If there are no other questions, I'm out of time. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Mr. Brewster, were you appointed in this matter?
I was.
Thank you for your service.
Well, it's always a pleasure to appear here.
Thank you. That takes us to the last case of the day, which is State versus Bryant L. Irish. I am recused from this matter, and Judge Reedman is also leaving the courtroom, so Justice Wright will preside.